Today on the Loopcast, I have senior reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Farnaz Fasihi, and we are discussing the protests in Iran. As anybody who is on Twitter or social media, these protests started on Thursday, and as with anything that's reported through Twitter, it's we're trying to figure out what's going on, who are the actors, and what is sort of what is happening, basically. So today, Farnaz is going to help me go through this and sort of figure out what is going on. So I want to start off with a really simple question, which is, when did the protests start? It's, by some accounts, it's on Thursday, on some account last Thursday, and then other accounts say Friday, but, when did they start, and what is sort of, a general reasoning for why these protests suddenly just came out into the open?
The protest started on Thursday in the northeastern city of Mashhad, which is a religious conservative city. They were instigated by one of the hardline factions to come out, called for sort of the working class and laborers to come out and protest the economic policies of President Hassan Rouhani. The protests started small. They started very economically focused, but within hours or 24 hours by Friday, they had spread like wildfire across Iran to small cities that have never really seen protests before. And the economic demand quickly shifted to political grievances against the government and calls for the Islamic Republic's ouster.
Interesting. So I want to maybe explore in one sort of explanation of why the protest started. It was with Rouhani, the president of Iran, comes out with this budget. And within this, this budget, apparently they were cutting religious money away from religious and other government institutions. Can you sort of, dig into this for us?
So Mr. Rouhani came under a lot of criticism for not delivering on economic prosperity fast enough, particularly after the nuclear deal and the lifting of sanctions. What he wanted to do was to be transparent with the public about the budget that he actually has for government financing and the things he does. So he made public and transparent the country's budget for the first time ever. And within that budget, there were a lot of millions and millions allocated to religious institutions and seminaries. And that really angered the public because they felt that money that should be pumped into the economy to create jobs, to create industries, was going to these religious centers without any sort of accountability or transparency on how they're spent and what happens to them. That was one of the reasons. Also, at parallel and at the same time, there was an announcement that a very popular retirement fund with some of the banks that had gone bankrupt. And this is sort of teachers and government employees and, very working class people, middle class people had put their, it's like a 401k, had put their money and their savings into these funds, and then they went bankrupt and they lost everything. I think these two forces together, in addition to the fact that there's still inflation, that the price of basic food items like eggs, like bread, like chicken, meat, it far exceeds the purchasing power of, the working class. And it sort of fueled the anger and the protests, as we've seen.
Interesting. So then when we discuss the protests themselves and the protesters, how would you describe? I mean, I think in a lot of accounts on Twitter, the protesters themselves have been described as middle class, as working class. But in your research, I mean, is this true? I mean, is it a fair assessment to say that the protesters are generally of middle and working class sort of economic sort of?
Yeah,
go ahead.
It is, because if we watch the demographics of where these protests are erupting, which cities, which parts of the neighborhoods in bigger cities, they're happening in working class neighborhoods and you know, like rural, smaller cities that are not very prosperous. The upper middle class, sort of a lot of the you know, wealthier people are sitting the protests out because they're very anxious about instability. They're worried that Iran may go the way of Syria or Yemen or other Libya or other countries in the region that had the Arab Spring and had a change of regime. But the working class is extremely angry, and this has been one of the weak, vulnerable points of Iran's regime, is that, you know, when you have the working class and the laborers come out, it's very hard to crush it, because this is a population that kind of has nothing to lose. You know, they're at a dead end, and they're willing to come out and battle the government. They also don't have the perhaps the political sophistication to patience to ask for reform and to ask for slow change and factions. They just want to see they're done with it, and they want to see change immediately. And that's why we've seen them target Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and we've seen them target the regime.
Interesting. Now, you know, when we talk about the protests, what is the level of violence? I mean, I know that sort of associating violence with protests isn't necessarily, you know, a good thing. But I mean, we've, you know, in reports from NPR yesterday, you know, we hear about 20 protesters dead, 30 protesters, and, you know, it's a varying number. But, you know, from what you've seen, what is the sort of general sense of, you know, violence and the use of violence in these protests?
I mean, I've covered protests and uprisings in Iran for two decades, and have watched this one very closely, you know, from videos that witnesses are sending us or on social media. And the way that usually it begins, the protests are peaceful, that people come out and they start chanting slogans and marching. And then the government deploys its security forces to crack down. And once that happens, then some of the protesters turn against the government, and then we see clashes and violence. So the violence is always initiated by the security forces. We've seen them open fire into crowds. We've seen videos of the police, anti-riot police, running over people, throwing tear gas and pepper gas and using water cannons. We have had reports of 21 people dead, and the majority were from two small towns. And then once that started happening, the protesters turned against the government. They've built government buildings. They've ransacked police stations. They've been tearing down Mr. Khamenei's posters. So it has taken a sort of an uprising undertone.
Interesting. So what has been, speaking of security forces, what has been sort of the IRGC and sort of associated elements, what has been their reaction? Because I think I read on Twitter, you know, they were sort of comparing the protests as being fueled by foreigners, by outsiders, by sort of, they were going out of their way to sort of discredit the protesters.
The reaction of the government and the regime as a whole this time has been a little different. Mr. Rouhani has tried to acknowledge the economic aspect of the protests and come out and say, look, we hear you. We know that you have economic issues and we have problems, and we promise to fix them, but don't turn this political. And the political things are being instigated by foreigners. So there's some attempt to differentiate the two and appease the sort of the poor people who are out in the streets and make it seem like they're being heard, while at the same time crush the political dissent. The Revolutionary Guards commander said yesterday that the guards had entered into the security foray in three provinces to try to sort of take control of security, where we saw a larger number of people out in the streets. But what the guards also do, and they've done it in every city, they do it every time, is deploy their plainclothes militia called the Basij, And these people don't wear a uniform. They're not easily identifiable, but they come in and they start beating people up and dispersing them and arresting them.
Interesting. So I want to maybe switch footing a bit to looking at the larger context, because it seems like on one sort of analysis of it, that these protests were started in a conservative city in Mashhad. And then you have one of the sort of the Ayatollah of Mashhad, I forget his name, was summoned in front of the National Security Council. And sort of the implication is that he sort of started these protests as a way of sort of having a hedge or leverage against Rouhani's budget. And my question is, when we view one context of these protests, is it sort of an internal battle between, you know, political factions in Iran, or are these protests genuine sort of demands for economic reform, or is it sort of, you know, as with most human things, more complex than that?
It's pretty complex because the demands of the protesters have a very wide range. They range from economic reform and, financial accountability and cries against financial corruption, all the way to the ouster of Mr. Khamenei and toppling of the Islamic Republic. So there's quite a wide range of demands and anger from the protesters. There is no doubt, I think, to most people in Iran watchers, these protests are genuine. The Iranian public has been asking for reform and change within the framework of the regime for 20 years since President Khatami came to power with the idea of reform. And the regime has crushed it, has tried to suppress these demands, and every time there's a chance, every time there's a crack, these demands resurface and people come out into the streets and sort of show their anger and show their voice. So, you know, we might see protests fizzle out, we might see them crushed, but the underlying reason for them, because it's never addressed, it also never goes away until the next time that it erupts.
Interesting. And then I think, I think the sort of common comparison that has come up a lot is comparing it to the Green Movement of 2009. Mm-hmm. And as you've sort of already pointed out, you've been covering this for two decades. So in your mind, how do the two compare? You know, if I remember, the Green Movement was, you know, in 2009, so you didn't have as much cell phone penetration, you didn't have as much Facebook, Twitter, Telegram, WhatsApp. And now, like, literally, like, I go on Twitter and I can see every videos from Mashhad, from Desfool, from Karet, video from every part of Iran. So, you know, as somebody who's been covering this, how do the two compare?
The nature of the two are very different. In 2009, the public had a very clear demand. It had very clear leadership. Its demands were within the framework of the Islamic Republic. People were demanding that there be a recount of election votes and to have their favorite candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, installed as president. And they were, he and Mr. Karoubi, the other opponent, were sort of leading the way, but it was very much a call for reform. It was a call for being their votes being taken seriously. We really didn't have these kinds of calls for Khamenei to go, or we don't want the Islamic Republic, not in the same wide sort of spectrum that we're seeing now. So this is one difference, that in 2009 was mostly limited to big cities and to university students and sort of the upper middle class and educated. The working class and, you know, poor people were not as involved. This time around, the demands are much more harsher and target the essence and the heart of the regime. They are bypassing the calls for reform, and sort of protesters are shouting, we're done with reformists, we're done with hardliners, all of you have to go. And the other thing is, we're seeing much more, as you mentioned, involvement of smaller towns. So some towns I've never even heard of. And because of social media, they're organizing and they're sharing in real time videos from all across Iran. This time around, there are all these phone apps like Telegram and like WhatsApp and others that are very popular in terms of sharing information and organizing. And that's why Iran's government has closed and blocked some of these applications and tried to limit the speed of the internet to try to control, you know, with the information that gets out, but also organization of crowds within the country.
Interesting. So, I mean, you know, with all this happening, what has been the sort of the Trump administration's reaction? Because it's kind of interesting watching this through Twitter. There's a palpable sort of sense of rage against the Trump administration, at least in the United States, because the argument was, oh, you've banned people from coming to the United States, and yet you're tweeting sort of sympathy and sort of, you know, the, you know, being pro-protester. And, you know, the messaging that's coming out of the Trump administration is very, seems mixed up or garbled or not consistent. But, you know, what has been the Trump administration's sort of reaction?
Mr. Trump immediately jumped into the foray of Iran protests and started tweeting about it from day one, and he's been tweeting about it every day. Vice President Pence, Speaker of the House, Ryan, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, all of them have expressed support for Iranian protesters and said that we're watching Iran's crackdowns and, you know, violations of human rights and all of that. And yesterday they said that we would do everything we can to amplify the voice of Iranians, although it's not exactly clear what they would do. So they've done all that, but as you pointed out, because this administration has not differentiated between ordinary Iranians and the government of Iran when it comes to the travel ban, Iranians inside Iran are very skeptical and reluctant to really trust Mr. Trump and his administration, because they feel that he didn't differentiate between them and the government. He banned them from entering the U.S., but now he's expressing his deep respect and deep support for them. So there is a lot of skepticism in terms of what the U.S. Can do. Also, you know, when I think while it's important for foreign governments to make it clear to Iran's government that if you're really keep them in check and put pressure on them to not kill or violently crack down on them, but too much outpouring of support also gives fodder to Iran's regime to say, look, these protests are not legitimate, they're being fueled by outside governments and outside forces, as we've seen them already do.
Is it your sense that the Trump administration is sort of linking the protests to the nuclear deal, that because of the protests and the ensuing crackdown, then, you know, we must, you know, decertify and reject the nuclear deal? Or is the Trump administration sort of keeping those two separate?
This administration is unpredictable. They've been looking for every excuse to decertify the deal. Another deadline is coming up for Mr. Trump to decertify, and I think it looks as if he will decertify. I don't think he's going to reverse that decision. But I think the key thing to watch is whether he's going to sign the waiver of sanctions, because as long as he signs the waiver of sanctions, the deal is kept in place despite the decertification. But if he decides to not sign that waiver and impose sanctions on Iran again, then essentially the U.S. is pulling out of the nuclear deal, and then, you know, it could all unravel from there.
Oh, okay. and then I think that's all my questions for today. And, you know,
excellent.
Thank
you. Those are very good questions.
We usually end on sort of letting our guests sort of give us something to think about before we leave for the day.
Okay.
So give us something to sort of think about and sort of to chew on about these protests.
Well, I think as an Iran watcher, you know, the protests in the larger context of what's going on in the Middle East and the civil wars and the existence of ISIS in Iraq, which is Iran's neighbor, and elsewhere, it's important to watch to see what will come of them and whether whether or not a vacuum of power or a vacuum of security in Iran would further destabilize the region, and at what cost would it come. So I think that's something that a lot of people are alarmed about, and while they want change in Iran and while they want to see more freedom and democratic Iran, but at the same time, there's a lot of concern about, you know, putting any sort of unrest into context of the larger Middle East and how that might affect things going forward.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sino.
Of course.